I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. With payrolls expanding for the third month in a row, the nation's unemployment rate fell in April to 6.3%. That was the good news from the Labor Department on Friday. The bad news is that more Americans just fell out of the labor force. Long-term unemployed accounted for a third of those who are jobless. For most of those who did have a job in April, wages were flat. Long-term unemployment and flat wages are two of the reasons why U.S. income inequality has reached a 50-year high. How bad is the income gap, and what are its long-term consequences for the U.S. economy and for the emerging class of young workers? Midday starts after the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for making Midday part of your day. The gap between rich and poor has been growing in the United States since the 1970s. On Friday, a report from the Federal Reserve Bank of Minnesota said the gap has reached a 50-year record, attributing the cause to two prime factors: the growing numbers of long-term unemployed and wage stagnation for employed people at the lower rungs of American society. From President Obama to Pope Francis, income inequality, the widening gap between rich and poor, has at long last become a recurring theme in public discourse in the U.S. and around the world. The new chair of the Federal Reserve, Janet Yellen, has called the growing income gap, quote, one of the most disturbing trends facing the nation. A new huge book, 577 pages, by French economist Thomas Piketty, surveys with panoramic sweep income inequality over 15 years in 30 countries and concludes that the trends we have seen in wealth concentration, the gains of the U.S. 1% in particular, are an inherent part of capitalism but ultimately incompatible with democracy and the concept of social justice. Capitalism, Piketty says, automatically creates levels of inequality that are unsustainable. He and others believe that these conditions offend democracy and portend oligarchy, that is, nations controlled by the very few with the greatest money and influence. Combine the phenomena of wealth and income disparity with Supreme Court rulings that liberalize laws regarding donations to political campaigns, and you can appreciate that concern. So we have a lot to talk about in this hour. Acknowledging income inequality is one thing, but what to do about it, and what are the consequences of doing nothing to address it, at least here in the United States? You can join us for the conversation on this hour of the show by calling 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance for the Midday Show at WYPR is 866-661-9309, and our email address for questions or comments, midday@wypr.org. Joining us today, Ken Solo is back, Chief Investment Officer of Pinnacle Advisory Wealth Managers in Columbia, Maryland. Ken, nice to see you again.
Great to be back, Dan.
Michael Reich is with us again, the Daniel Thurs Distinguished Professor of Social Justice at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. Welcome back, Michael.
Thank you, Dan. Good to be here.
And Barbara Morgan is back on Midday with us, lecturer in economics at the Johns Hopkins University, senior lecturer there. Barbara, nice to have you with us.
Nice to be back. Thanks.
Ken, I'm going to start with you. You're sort of the founder of today's feast. It was your idea to discuss income inequality on Midday this time. We have talked about it before. And I learned from the financial press that your company, Pinnacle, manages $1.3 billion in assets from more than 800 clients. So a listener might wonder why you'd even want to engage the subject of income inequality.
Well, first, I would say that for our clients and for the investing class, and far be it for me to speak for the 1%, but clearly issues of income inequality could have much to do with the returns on capital and returns on their money. So to the extent that income inequality leads to slower economic growth, reduced spending, those things have a very real impact to that class of folks who have assets. Second of all, to the extent that income inequality has always led to social unrest, again, another terrible thing. Believe me, Wall Street kept quite an eye on the recent protests, Wall Street And so they're, again, of interest. But I think more my own personal interest is that it's a very nuanced subject, very difficult subject, one that has a lot of moving parts, and that makes it interesting. And hopefully it'll be a good discussion today.
What's different about today? Michael and Barbara, I'll go to you. You know, people listening to this, and every time we have this conversation, they say, well, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. That's the way it's always been. That's the way it'll always be. But what else is new?
Well, we have seen an increased inequality, income inequality, for the last 40 years, since 1970. But the nature of that has changed a little bit. For the first 20 or so years of that period, generally there was a broad increase in inequality, and generally what is thought by most economists who have driven that is differences in skill. So folks with high levels of skill and education were doing well in this increasingly global economy, and those with low skills were not doing so well. But since about the early 1990s, the nature of the inequality has changed, and we now see much more action right at the top of the distribution, right among this top 1%. And one of the reasons we know that is because precisely of this new research that's come out by Thomas Piketty, and also by his co-author, not in this book, but in earlier articles, Emmanuel Saez from the University of California, Berkeley. And instead of using survey data, which has top coding, so you can't look at those folks at the top, they use tax records. And so now we have a lot more detail about what's going on at the top of the distribution.
So it's widened, Michael Reich, over a 35 to 40-year period. Also, more wealth has become concentrated at the top.
I think that that's the critical part, that it's not just the inequality of income, but it's also a growing inequality of wealth, and that this is increasingly concentrated in not just the top 1%, but the top 0.1%. I think another thing that's changed is that many of the social policy factors that kept inequality from doing what Piketty describes as capitalism's natural tendency have been removed or drastically cut back, such as taxes. I mean, for example, in the 1980s, we started taxing capital gains at a significantly lower rate than income. So that's one factor. We've had dramatic cutbacks in education, particularly in higher education, and that's removed a major vehicle for economic mobility and opportunity. We've cut social welfare spending, and as we'll discuss later, I hope, all those things in combination mean that the United States is much less effective in reducing inequality than other industrialized countries. And just to pick up on one last point that Ken mentioned, the notion that there's growing inequality might produce social unrest is also, it's not just the inequality, it's the lack or the shrinking lack of opportunity that is very important. And if we look at societies that are in upheaval right now, such as in the Middle East, the class that's moving that upheaval most are not necessarily the poorest folk in society, but folks who previously believed that they would have an opportunity to get a decent job, raise a family, have a wage that could support a family. And that is the class that's increasingly frustrated, infuriated, and fueling social unrest. And I think that's possible for it to occur in the United States.
I think it's a good idea to talk a little bit about that, Ken, because the way wealth is accumulated, the way wealth becomes concentrated today, maybe it's the way it always was. It has to do with inheritance, for one thing. But also, it counters this idea that you could work hard and be industrious and get ahead, that there's mobility in hard work that pays off for you in America.
Yeah, interestingly, and before we even get to that, it might be helpful to maybe define our terms a little bit. I think listeners might be surprised to be in the top 10% of earning households in the United States. So to be ahead of 90% of everybody else, the number you need to get to is $114,000. So I don't think most of us would view that as the uber rich. To be in the top 1% is a little over $380,000. And you have to keep in mind that these things are done now. The measurements are in households, not families. So when you look through the demographics of households, you begin to see things that won't surprise you at all. Households with two earners are in the top fifth, and with less than in the lower fifth, there's half an earner in those households. A huge difference in education, employment, all the usual suspects that we can talk about if you'd like. Interestingly, about opportunity, the studies that I've seen, most notably recently out of Harvard, shows that income mobility, which is what we're talking about, has been stayed pretty much the same over the last 20 or 30 years. And we're talking two things. One is absolute mobility. In other words, we all go through our life where we start out with low incomes and then move to higher incomes. It's just our ability to move from the lower decile to the higher decile. And those people who move from the higher decile to the lower decile, I have those numbers. We can talk about that. What's curious is Americans don't seem overly concerned about this. When you think they would, the issue is America has less mobility than almost all the other developed countries. So we have the American dream. We're taught the American dream. Our mobility has been about the same, according to the studies I've seen, but it's less than other countries in Europe and so forth. The reasons for that, those parts of the country with less segregation, less income inequality, better schools, greater social capital, more stable families, those are the areas that you find more mobility and less on the other side.
Barbara Morgan, what else accounts for that, the lack of mobility in terms of wages, for instance, income?
Well, I'd just like to address that particular point that Cam made. That is a very interesting and very new study by Raj Chetty and Emmanuel Sayers. They looked at 40 million tax records to come up, and they looked across different regions. One of the areas they looked at was Baltimore. So if you're a kid in the top fifth of the income distribution in Baltimore, your chances of staying there are 40%. If you're a kid in the bottom fifth of the income distribution, the chances of you getting to the top are 5%. So those life chances are very, very different. And I absolutely agree with what Ken said, that some of the factors they saw were influencing mobility, one of them was income inequality. That was a huge driver. Education.
You mean where you start? You mean where you start?
No. What areas that had high levels of income inequality?
Oh, okay.
Areas that had less good education, lower levels, and less good education. They were the ones where the mobility was least.
And what about the loss of labor unions? I just want to throw that one in here, Michael Reich. Well, that's another factor, would it not be?
Well, that in combination with stagnation in overall wages and freezing of the minimum wage for many years in the 80s and 90s all contributed to that. I also think the deindustrialization of many cities like Baltimore and the loss of well-paying jobs that people with a high school education could obtain, they all occurred in combination. And then, of course, globalization, in which many jobs have been outsourced out of the United States, and American workers are now competing with workers in India and other countries that will do the same work just as well at a lower wage. If you look at international studies which use a measure called the Gini coefficient, which measures comparative equality, the United States falls below virtually every industrialized country in the West and even below countries like Pakistan. So I think that's pretty dramatic. The other thing that to look at this notion of relative stable social mobility that we have to look at is that that's been achieved in terms of household income by more and more families having two wage earners. And that requires additional expenditures like childcare and transportation and health care. And those things are not factored into people's aggregate income, but do detract from their ability to have disposable income. So when Ken says that many families who earn $114,000 a year don't feel like they're particularly wealthy, it's because after all those expenses are subtracted, they really don't have as much disposable income as one would think a family in the top 10% would have.
I want to go back to, before our break here, this question I raised with you, Ken, about wealth concentration and inheritance. This is Piketty, Thomas Piketty, makes a lot of that in his book, apparently. So that's not really making money, is it? I mean, that's inheriting money, and our Congress in the United States has reduced the taxes, the liability on inheritance over the last several years.
Yeah, I can't speak to
that's there and that's
that
not going anywhere,
issue.
Right?
To me, a far bigger issue would be technology, for example. In this discussion, we have a cohort now of knowledge workers who are highly educated, whose job it is to find technologies to take the jobs from those folks, typically in the middle class, who used to have jobs that were protected and now they're not. So what's interesting is that lower wage earners, like hairdressers and things like that, those are skilled jobs that can't be replaced with technology. But many types of bookkeeping and medical technology jobs and so forth are being replaced as the knowledge workers are that's their task. What's happening is that we're increasing productivity and we're enormously increasing corporate profits, and the share of corporate profits in U.S. GDP continues to grow. The news being that is a notoriously mean reverting series, so it won't continue to grow forever, which is Piketty's a big part of his book. But in the meantime, then, you have the middle class getting hollowed out, and actually it's the 90th percentile and the 10th percentile that's strangely actually gaining at the percent of the middle class.
But that money and, that it's the top that I'm focusing on, that 1% or even the 1% of the 1%, all that money that's focused at the top, it doesn't seem to be trickling down in terms of investment in creating jobs and creating growth.
Well, I would think, but here in Maryland, if you work for Under Armour, you would probably disagree. And I think, but your point is well taken. To the extent we have technology companies that have far fewer employees, just generally, then I think your point's well taken.
Well, the CEO to worker ratio is huge. A lot of what is driving this inequality are those very high earnings at the top of the distribution. Then that, of course, feeds into wealth inequality. Wealth inequality is much greater than income inequality, but it feeds into wealth inequality because you're gaining these huge million-dollar salaries at top, and that's going to have implications for wealth, okay? And some of those ratios are incredible. If we look back in time, 1980, CEO compensation was 40 times that of the average worker. Today, it's much more than that. JCPenney, 1,800 to 1. Abercrombie & Fitch, 1,800 to 1.
But it's
McDonald's
important.
Is relatively equitable, only 350 to 1.
What
not
were you
too bad.
Say, Ken?
It's just important to realize it's not salaries. What's happened, and a lot of people are saying that because over $1 million of earnings, the taxes are actually much more onerous than they used to be, that executives are taking a huge percentage of their income in stock options.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And so when you're looking at capital gains and stock options, especially the options, it drives these numbers to these astronomic figures that Barbara's mentioning, but it's not wages and salary.
I was going to say the same thing. I think that also the largest growth in profit in the United States has been in the financial sector.
Yes.
That's the fastest growing sector. And the financial sector doesn't produce goods and services that affect the average person. The other thing is that the profits can continue to grow, but they don't have to generate anything of value in the United States because of globalization. So they can invest overseas where there would be a higher profit margin to serve their stockholders. The other thing about that is that a lot of this investment, as we've seen in the last 20 years, is in speculative investment, which creates inevitable bubbles in the area of housing or the dot-com boom and so forth. And that ultimately has not proven to punish the people who profit from it. It punishes the people who are hurt by it, such as, you know, low-income
homeowners.
In the last year. One last statistic. In 2012, the top 10% of earners took home more than half of the nation's total income, and 93% of all additional income went to the top 1%. And 37% of that went to the top 0.01%. So the top 1%, these folks making over $380,000, earn almost a quarter of all income in the United States now.
That's Michael Reich, a professor of social justice at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. Also joining me this hour, Barbara Morgan, senior lecturer in economics at Johns Hopkins University, and Ken Solo with us, chief investment officer of Pinnacle Advisory Wealth Managers based in Columbia, Maryland. We'll continue our conversation about income and wealth inequality when we get back. How bad is it, and what are the long-term consequences for the U.S. economy and the emerging class of young workers. If you'd like to join our conversation, 410-662-8780. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. With payrolls expanding for the third month in a row, the nation's unemployment rate fell in April to 6.3%. That was the third consecutive month of growth of 200,000 jobs or more. That, of course, was the good news. The bad news is that more Americans just fell out of the labor force. Long-term unemployed, I think that's 6 months or more unemployed, accounted for a third of those who are jobless currently, the Labor Department said on Friday. And for most of those folks who did have a job in April, wages were flat. That's what we get from the Labor Department's latest report. We're talking about income inequality here with Barbara Morgan from Johns Hopkins University, Michael Reich from the University of Maryland School of Social Work, and Ken Solo, who is Chief Investment Officer of Pinnacle Advisory Wealth Managers in Columbia. So, Barbara Morgan, I'll go to you on that. We just heard from Ken and then Michael on the forces at work here and not creating jobs. You know, you have all this profit, all this capital, all this asset, all these assets, and we're not seeing the job growth. Even though that looks good, 6.3%, it indicates, as I just said, a lot of folks have dropped out of the market.
Yes, we're not seeing the job growth from this investment. The recession ended in June 2009, and of course the unemployment rate has gone down since then. But the unemployment rate can go down for a couple of reasons. One is that if you're unemployed and then you get a job, but the other reason it can go down is you're unemployed and you drop out of the labor market because you've been looking for so long and it's a hopeless case. And that is what has been going on. The employment to population ratio has not been growing. So this is basically a jobless recovery.
I mean, this feeds into this question of social unrest that you raised earlier, Ken. It's no small thing to talk about this. People see profits going to companies. We see these mega mergers taking place now on Wall Street. And people don't feel that there is a recovery. They don't see it. They don't see better jobs. They don't see wages being increased.
Yeah, I think part of the irony here, we were talking about the employment numbers, is that our Federal Reserve, we've talked about this before, has a dual mission to fight inflation and create full employment. And Janet Yellen, being very concerned about what's considered to be structural unemployment, has said she's going to keep rates very, very low until we see some increase. Yet, ironically, it's those low rates that are disproportionately helping the upper 1%. She's inflating these assets, and they're the ones that seem to be benefiting. I was looking up some statistics just comparing the highest fifth to the lowest fifth of income earners. And some of these numbers, I think, will be kind of obvious that in the lowest fifth, 61% of households have no earners. 3% of the highest fifth have no earners. So it's huge unemployment. The income per earner is $89,000 in the highest fifth. It's $25,000 in the lowest fifth. You get 77% of the highest fifth are in married couple families, and only 17% in the lowest fifth. We already talked about the ages. 78% of the highest fifth work full-time. Okay. 67% of the lowest fifth either don't work, and 18% work full-time. So, and then finally, the big one to me is the education. 77% of the highest fifth have a bachelor's degree, and only 13% of the lower fifth have a bachelor's degree. So you get into these social issues that I think need to be addressed if we're going to solve this.
First of all, I'd like to go back to the first point that Ken made, was the effect of quantitative easing on assets. We have two ways of dealing with a very fragile recovery. One is monetary policy, one is fiscal policy. Since 2009, the Fed has had a policy of quantitative easing, which is exactly the right policy that you have to have. If they had not pursued that policy, the unemployment rate would have been much, much higher than it was before. The problem is we are not getting private sector investment that is creating jobs. So what's the fiscal response to that? We need a fiscal stimulus. We need government to come in and invest because the private sector is not investing. Government to invest in skills and education, government to invest in in public infrastructure, including communications, government to invest in green energy. What that will do is will give a short-term boost to the economy, but more importantly, it will build a 21st century labor force and a 21st century infrastructure.
Does the government take on more debt to do that, or does the government raise taxes?
That's not the only option, Dan. It could also shift its spending priorities as well. I mean, but I think it requires all of those things. I would like to throw in a pitch for the third leg of this, which is increased spending on social welfare. And yet the Congress seems to be going in the opposite direction, because the money that is spent in transfer payments or other forms of assistance, such as nutritional assistance, is not something that people squirrel away under their mattress, but rather something that they spend, which then stimulates the economy and creates jobs. And it seems that in the focus on fiscal austerity that has been, you know, a fever in Washington now for some years, that element has been the first to go, that we have not addressed either the fiscal policy, the public sector investment, or the social welfare policy, that we would need to create a truly well-founded and, you know, broadly based recovery.
What about taxes, Ken Solo? I'll come back to you on that. I can't imagine anybody complaining too much about the state of taxes in the United States now. Anyone in the top 1%, for instance?
Well, you would be wrong.
Am I wrong?
Yes.
They think that our taxes are still too high?
Because they pay such...
These are people lacking perspective, I think.
Obviously, they must be wrong. But the fact is they would cite... the statistics that show that the 1% pay a disproportionate amount, a gigantic amount of the total taxes, and we would go down that political road that doesn't
really
get us
anywhere. Well, how else do you do
it?
You have to confront it politically. This has to be. We're talking about it on the radio today, and the conversation has started in the United States. It's belated, but it needs to be discussed, and it is a political issue. It has to become.
Right.
One.
So first of all, I'm not a political guy, so I don't want to offend anyone, but I would think that conservatives would be saying, are we paying as much attention to restructuring our education with dynamic new programs to invest that are highly productive investments, as opposed to talking about income redistribution and where is the productivity of that particular
investment.
I'm
with you, but it's still going to cost money. A better educational system is going to cost money. People say, well, you can't just throw money at education and assume it's going to be better. I don't believe that either. But we're talking about investment by the government.
Well, there are lots of studies out there to show that investment in education has a very high rate of return. So, for example, a fairly recent study by Mathematica, if you take the high school dropouts, the men, a very troublesome group, and you even give them training and you give them skills, you can get a rate of return of 10.5%. What we mean by that is that the differential in their earnings discounted over time, which is basically a measure of productivity. And it's exactly the same kind of way that you analyze investment in physical capital. You invest in educational capital, and it gives you a very good return.
And that's precisely what other nations have done, both the industrialized nations of Europe and in Asia as well. And their investment in education is one of the reasons why social mobility now in those countries is greater than that in the United States. I also want to throw in something here that's always the elephant in the living room that nobody wants to talk about, and that the issue of social inequality is even worse if you look at the issue of racial inequality. As I've said on the program before, for the past 60 years, the poverty rate is 2.5 to 3 times higher among African Americans and Latinos than it is among whites. But in addition to that, over the last 25 years, the wealth gap in the United States between African American and white households has tripled. The average assets for in 2014 dollars of African American households has gone up from under $6,000 to a little bit over $28,000 in the 25-year period. In the same period for white households, it's gone from about $91,000 to over $293,000. So not only is there a huge income gap on the basis of race, there is also a huge wealth gap and a huge opportunity gap because of the cuts in spending on education and job training that Barbara and Ken have referred to.
And then we had the subprime mortgage crisis, the housing crisis, the housing bubble burst, the recession. I think there was a significant setback in that period. There were gains being made, and then I think African-American wealth sustained a significant setback during that period in particular.
You know, it's a good point you raise. A lot of studies that I'm looking at talk to the fact that that bubble in debt really masked a lot of the deterioration in income inequality we're talking about. The middle class was using debt to support a standard of living. I think most professionals think those days are over. And so you're exactly right to bring up subprime mortgages and that type of thing.
Ken Solo is Chief Investment Officer with Pinnacle Advisory based in Columbia, Maryland. Barbara Morgan, Senior Lecturer in Economics at Johns Hopkins. And Michael Reich is the Daniel Thurs Distinguished Professor of Social Justice at the UM School of Social Work, University of Maryland. Let's go to the phone lines and start taking calls from our listeners joining in our conversation here about income and wealth inequality. Tom in Aberdeen, thank you for calling. Go right ahead, Tom.
Yeah, thanks, Dan, and thanks to your guests. You know, there's an issue that I'm not hearing a whole lot of discussion about, and it kind of bugs me a little bit, this idea that nobody is considering spending habits or wants versus needs. I'm 55 now. When I was 18, my father died suddenly, and my mom went back to work after being a stay-at-home mom, and there was a lot of stuff we didn't have. You know, we didn't go on vacations. We didn't buy fancy cars. I realized technology wasn't available. You know, we didn't have 10 TVs in the house. Fast forward today, and I think one of your guests just made the point about people supporting a lifestyle with debt. I mean, part of this is personal responsibility. It's not only about your lot in life, but it's about changing or adapting your lifestyle to help yourself get out of that. And I know there's extremes and people can't do that, but you know, you can't just blame everybody else for, you know, the fact that you have to buy a car with chrome wheels and have 10 iPhones. There was an article in the Washington Post.
Well, hold on, Tom. Tom, hold on a minute. Did you hear Ken earlier describing how the income mobility in the United States, how far we are behind, what did you say, even Western European countries?
Most countries
in terms of income mobility. So you might, we're talking here about income inequality, wealth, the wealth gap, and also the lack of income mobility for people. So you might, someone always raises this issue about lifestyle choices, and it's based on anecdotal information, and that's fine if you want to go with anecdotal stuff. I want to look at the bigger picture today in terms of the numbers, if you don't mind. Don't like statistics.
One other thing about Tom's comment, though, I think it's interesting that, you know, Americans are always encouraged to behave that way. I mean, when
spend money.
I mean, look at the whole advertising industry, our whole consumer culture, the whole notion that success is equal to possession of material things. I mean, President Bush even said that after 9/11, what we should do is go shopping. So, I mean, this is people are just doing what they're being asked to do. I mean, it's interesting that in the last 40 years, when we were competing with Japan, which is now suffering chronic deflation and stagnation, we were told that Americans don't save enough. And now during the after the recession, we're told Americans don't spend enough. So Americans are sort of in a yo-yo
but
situation.
But, you know, this does come up a lot. People make this point that this is a lifestyle choice. You know, you choose to be poor. You choose to be middle class. Or you choose to be super wealthy. It all comes down to your ambition and mostly ambition rather than social status or where you began your trek for your career or whatever it was. Not how much you inherited, but you know, how willing you were to work hard.
Well, I think this idea of working hard, that's how we economically we justify a certain amount of inequality, because a certain amount of inequality provides incentives, incentives to work hard, incentives to innovate, incentives to invest, okay, and so on and so forth. And so that's always the idea that if we increase taxes at the top end, all that will fall apart and people won't work hard and we'll lose all this talent. But, you know, what about the talent at the bottom of the distribution that we're not supporting? What about the talent of the high school dropouts? What about the talent of the kids who don't get a quality education? What about the talent of the woman running two part-time jobs and bringing up a kid who doesn't have time to take off or money to be able to invest in further training that will improve her life and improve her
or have daycare, afford daycare.
Exactly.
And in order to take advantage of that talent, societies need to invest through redistribution of in various ways, both through the tax system and through social policy expenditures. Let me just quote you a few statistics. The pre-tax, pre-transfer level of poverty, which means before we factor in how the tax system works and social policy, in France is 31%. In the United States, it's 26%. After taxes and transfers, the poverty rate in France is 7%. In the United States, it's 17%. And similar statistics can be applied to the United Kingdom and many other Western European countries. The message that that shows is that all societies, which are all market-oriented capitalist economies, create inequality. You could argue whether that's good or bad or just, as Piketty says, inevitable. But societies do have some control as to the extent to which they can reduce poverty and inequality. And our society has moved in the opposite direction of other industrialized countries.
You know, one of the things that I find very disturbing is the whole notion of crony capitalism. I mean, the caller, to me, he was voicing the American dream. We all believe that we can get ahead. The notion of mobility and equality of opportunity is so central to who we are. That's why I find the whole subject disturbing. I wrote down some notes as to why the demand for redistribution or even addressing income inequality remains low. The first is, I wrote, money talks. More than 40% of campaign contributions from federal elections came from 0.01% of the voting age population. In 2012, only 24,000 people were responsible for just about the majority of all campaign contributions. Put that together with what we've been talking about, primacy of capital over labor, weak labor unions, persistence of globalization. And then there is institutional hurdles to change, like filibusters and so forth. So some of this comes from investment research trying to calm investors worrying about this change in social unrest. But I think the points are well made, you know.
And half of the members of Congress are millionaires. We forget that.
John in Remington will take your call, add your voice to this conversation. Hello.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm on page 558 of Piketty's book. I got like 20 pages to go. And I've been reading this with a highlighter in one hand like I'm a college kid, okay? So I just had a comment and then a question. I think my comment would be, I heard you talking about, or your guest talking about education, and I think to speak for Piketty for a second, he would say that's important, but that's not going to reverse the whole R greater than G thing. That's not enough. It's not enough to really reduce the rate of increase of income inequality. But my question is, you know, I just got an email from Elizabeth Warren, which I'm sure I wasn't the only person she emailed and said there's a conference in D.C. on the new populism. And I'm wondering, you know, Piketty talks about a revolt by the middle class, and it's hard for me to imagine what that would look like. And I wanted to ask your guest, is this potential revolt by the middle class, is it going to be manifest by something like the new populism, do they think, or is it going to be a sort of aggressive or reactionary sort of Tea Party type movement? How do they see this popular unrest at increasing inequality manifesting itself?
Michael, you want to take that?
Well, that's a very complicated question. As we've seen in the last, you know, 20 or 30 years, a lot of the so-called middle-class taxpayer revolt has taken on a conservative tone, particularly if it's captured by people in, you know, fundamentalist churches and is fueled by major, mega-wealthy people like the Koch brothers. I think in order for that to occur, there needs to be some organizational structure that shows how working class, middle class, and lower income people have common interests. Labor unions and some political parties used to perform that function. We don't have it right now. Without that organizing structure, what occurs is that the wedge issue of race and sometimes religion gets thrust between possible allies, and makes it very hard for that middle class revolt to take on a progressive overtone.
It's hard to see it galvanizing. It is. And given the Supreme Court rulings on campaign contributions to further insulating the political class from this voice. We'll take a break here. 410-662-8780. This is Midday. We'll be right back. A couple of emails to read here. The top 1% pay 37% of all income taxes. 30 years ago, the top 1% paid only 20% of all income taxes. It is not the tax policies that is skewing inequality. The principal problem has been the growth of mergers and acquisitions and all that activity. In the late 1960s, the Fortune 500 constituted 38% of the non-governmental GDP. Today it makes up 72%. If the Fortune 500 today were devolved into, say, 5,000 companies, there would be a lot of middle-class jobs. What do you think of that comment, Ken?
Yeah, I think that it's basically getting to the point we made before, that the structure of profits as opposed in GDP is at an all-time high in the U.S. And when you see that, then the folks that are getting paid options and so forth based on that. The other thing is 2007 was the peak earnings so far statistically for the upper 1%. It's been coming down since 2007. And so that's one of the things that is out there that perhaps rates of return, which gets us back to Piketty, which is, it cannot be sustained indefinitely that rates of return on capital exceed economic growth. It's mean reverting.
The plaint that the wealthy pay the lion's share of income taxes in the United States, we have a progressive income tax system.
Much less progressive than it used to be.
Than it used to be. Nonetheless, we have a lot of more people earning a lot less at the bottom, don't we? Isn't that primarily the reason
for it? But I think we also have to look at the overall tax system in the United States. And as more responsibility has been thrust back through devolution on the states and localities, which rely increasingly on regressive taxes like sales taxes, the notion that because lower-income people don't pay as large a share of income tax doesn't mean that they don't pay a lot of taxes. They pay the payroll tax, which is regressive. They pay sales tax, which is regressive. And I think that detracts from their overall disposable income, which, of course, creates another stagnation factor in the economy.
Let's take another call from Frederick. This is Barb. Welcome to Midday.
Hi. I think term limits would do a huge, would be a great benefit. As somebody had mentioned, a lot of the people governing our country are millionaires, and they get perks. They're driven to work. Their bar bills are paid for entertaining, and their public associates are the 1%. That's who their, peers are. And, they can spend in the billions like we spend in the $10 range. It's, I think if term limits were put in, our country would save so much money in the deficit and earnings. As the person just said about the sales tax.
Okay. Barbara, thank you.
We're out here struggling.
Thank you.
And these guys are flying around the country on their own jets.
Yeah.
And their peers are the 1%.
Okay. Just a quick comment on that. In states that have implemented, term limits, there has not been a noticeable improvement either in the way in which state governments manage money or in the composition of who comprises the state legislature. In fact, if there are more elections like that, two things would happen. One is that the lobbyists and the power would still basically control an even greater control over the policymaking process. Second thing is that the statistic that Ken cited before about who funds campaigns would become even more prominent because more people would be running for office and they would be more dependent, of course, on these wealthy individuals. So there is really no evidence in the last 20 or 30 years that term limits produce any better outcomes for the American people.
Ryan in Baltimore, you're up next. Thanks for calling Midday.
Hello, Dan. Thank you for having me today.
Sure.
Great topic today. One thing I'd like to point out that we talked about earlier is the racial generational wealth gap. I think that's a major issue because as far as African-Americans, I'm African-American, and we've, you know, due to slavery and Jim Crow and things like that, it's been way harder for us to gain wealth. And that, in turn, makes it harder to go to school, find a better job, things like that. And that plays into the whole, not just race, but lower class. Because I think race is just a part of capitalism and just a way to have a permanent workforce that you can pay less. Because if you have a whole race of people that are deemed second class, you can pay them whatever you want to. And that, in part, plays to making it harder for the bottom of society to move up.
Thank you, Ryan. Barbara?
Yeah, I just want to make a couple of quick points about that. The first, with respect to the racial gap in incomes, there is a wage gap in income. Part of that is driven by educational differences and opportunities and skills. And a lot of kids dropping out of college, low labor force participation rates. Some of that is also driven by discrimination. Okay, so those two things are influencing that. But the income differences lead to the wealth differences. And if you have no wealth, what does that mean? You don't have any ability to weather the bad times. You don't have any ability to invest in education. You don't have any ability to take out a loan to start a business. So it severely restricts opportunity.
So, Ken, what is the upshot for you on this? I'm glad you brought this. You wanted to talk about this today. Last time you were here, we were talking about investment in Wall Street and the market and what's going to be coming up this coming year as you saw it. But I'm glad you wanted to talk about this today. So for you and the people you represent, clients, your customers, and I know you're not speaking for all of them, but what do you think can be done about this? How does the middle class gain? Are we ever going to see this gap close?
I mean, this is just me speaking personally. Yeah. That I believe that it's the productivity of how we use this tax money. What are we doing that is adding value? And years from now, we'll look back. So whether it's infrastructure spending or spending on education, those are things that I believe will have a real impact on our economic growth. And as the economic pie continues to grow, if we're investing properly, just like Michael and Barbara were saying.
You do believe that the government needs to be the investor here in those things?
I do believe
because
that.
There are others who say, you know, reduce taxes, less government, let the private sector take care of things.
Well, I think that there's probably room for all. There's room for all of that. I was mentioning to you before, there are some structural solutions coming down the road. I've seen statistics as much as 70-75% of income inequality is just due to age and demographics. So as the baby boomers are retiring, that's going to have a big impact on these numbers. If there's a manufacturing renaissance, and we're hearing about that now, that could have a big difference. There's an erosion of globalization perhaps taking place as China builds their own consumer economy. You're beginning to see those tensions. If we have a stronger than expected recovery, all of those things are things that could have an impact, and we would look at these numbers differently.
Michael, in wrapping up today?
Well, I think Ken raised some very good points. I just think that we also have to have a conversation about what kind of a society we want to have. Do we want to have a more equal society in which there is true equality of opportunity, or do we want to have a society in which there's continuing, you know, growing gaps socially, economically, politically between classes? Or do we want to have a society like some European societies do, in which we establish a basic minimum of decency, and then above that, people can get as wealthy as they can?
Michael Reich is the Daniel Thurs Distinguished Professor of Social Justice at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. Ken Solo is Chief Investment Officer of Pinnacle Advisory Wealth Managers in Columbia, Maryland. And Barbara Morgan has been with us, too, Senior Lecturer in Economics at the Johns Hopkins University. I thank you all for participating in this discussion today. To be continued. Thank you very much, Barbara, Michael.
Thank you.
And Ken.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in. That's the first hour of Midday. We have some emails left over with comments from listeners about this topic that I'll share with you on another day. Right now, we take a break for lunch, brought to us on Mondays by Atwaters. Atwaters supports local radio, local farmers, and local appetites. Located at Belvedere Square, the shops at Kenilworth, Bear Hills, Main Street, Catonsville, and now at Camden Crossing. Visit atwaters.biz for more information.